We're going to come to order here. This is a subcommittee of the subcommittee. Representative Weston asked me to go ahead and get the hearing going. He'll be here shortly, and hopefully the rest of the committee. We have one other member.
Oh.
We did. Want to proceed? Okay, Mr. Hill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and member of the committee, Rick Hill, Director of the Oregon Youth Authority. I wanted to start this afternoon by giving some follow-up on some issues that we brought up Monday and correcting a couple of documents that we discovered during and after our testimony were probably not right. So I want to first refer you to page 9. In the book under the agency summary. It is the profile entitled Youth Offender Characteristics or the Two Faces. And we've given you a new sheet to put in your book. The corrections are on the left side. We had 3% of these youth had a past residential placement. In fact, that new number is 36%. We knew that was wrong as soon as we saw it. I didn't say it yesterday. I knew it was wrong. It was just, a typo. Likewise, on the right side, and perhaps a more significant correction, on the right side of the profile, we'd indicated that 31% of our youth were already parents, had children of their own, and we had a little discussion on that, and as we were having that discussion, we thought, gosh, that sounds high. Well, in fact, that was a transposure of those numbers. It is 13%, not 33%, or not 31%, so we apologize for that misrepresentation. If you turn to pages 10, 11, and 12, we have been indicating that on January 1, 1999, we had 164 Measure 11 offenders in our physical custody. And we also had the question from Senator Burdick about what is the impact of Senate Bill 1049 last session. Well, in fact, we discovered that our 164 did not match what Sue Porter had for that forecast. Her number was 149. So what we found out is that we were that 15 bed difference are in fact the Senate Bill 1049 youth who were charged with the Measure 11 crime, convicted of the Measure 11 crime, but because of Senate Bill 1049, they were given the reduction. They were given the sentence guideline sentence instead. So we have continued to code them as Measure 11 inaccurately in our system. So we're going to correct that in the future in our data system, and I wanted to set the record straight on that as well. So it does not change the bet forecast numbers, and nor does it have any impact on our projection for the second look. The next thing I want to point out is on page, it's actually another new page that's given to you today, page 16A. It's another insert. And it responds to Senator Tim's question regarding the federal match on the rates for our private residential centers. So we've listed those on the new insert. It also lists a column entitled pre-BRS rates, pre-behavior rehab services rates. So these are the rates that the providers used to get before we converted to the BRS formula. For example, level 4 BRS residential centers used to get $78 a day under the new arrangement. They will get $121 a day for every youth, thus making it possible to convert to the fee-for-service system that we discussed on Monday. I just want to refer to the flow chart that I put up there, and perhaps any time during the next several days we can refer to that. Senator Kim's had a number of questions about youth at the front end of the system and the level 7 money and kind of how the system works. And this is a flow chart of the juvenile justice system, and we felt it was important to post it up so that if we need to get into that discussion, we have a vehicle to do that. And lastly, I just want to point out we brought in the architect's model of our five new regional facilities. And it's there for you, for the members, whenever you want to go over and look at it, take a break or something, and we'll have to explain the layout. We would have, of course, done this on the tour yesterday, but schedules were such that we were unable to get you to Oak Creek, so we brought Oak Creek to you. So with that, those are my corrections, and we'll go ahead, I guess, with Mr. McGee and then have Mr. Jester come up and talk about facilities.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Bill McGee, the Department of Administrative Services. Today, we're going to begin to discuss the facilities section of OYA with you, and I'd like to review the governor's budget proposal for you. Staff is distributing the handout on that. The governor's revised budgets for the facilities and debt service, those two are budgeted together, although we'll talk about debt service when we get into the administration and capital construction part of the presentation, but they do appear in this part of the budget direct recording system. But the governor's revised general fund for this program unit is $120 million. Total fund is $129.9. The general fund is increased by just under 12% from the legislative approved budget, and the total fund is increased by 12.5% approximately from the approved budget. The proposal for this unit incorporates the April 99 population forecast that you heard a couple weeks ago. It reduces some beds in anticipation of the second look legislation that we've discussed with you so far. And it also includes $13.1 million general fund for debt service on previously approved projects involving facilities construction, such as the facilities you've seen an architect model for, and the development of the juvenile justice information system.
Bill, if I could just interrupt you for a minute, what happens if second month does not pass?
Then there will be a $4 million operating problem in this budget, and with the additional 59 beds, there'll be a need to begin to construct some beds to deal with the population growth forecast next biennium. And the number for that is about another $2.5 million. So if that bill doesn't pass or doesn't pass in the form we have it now, there's about a $6 million hole. And part of that is would be probably COPs rather than general funds. Taking quickly through the development of the governor's budget, we started with a $93 million general fund, legislatively adopted budget, and a 100.6 total funds, 968 FTE positions. The emergency board actions were salary adjustments, part of the suicide prevention program funds in the institutions, and federal grants to construct the Eastern Oregon boot camp that's currently in progress being built now. Our current service level adjustments were standard position and inflation increases. The phase in the operations cost, the five new regional facilities, the two boot camp and suicide prevention programs all are being phased in for a full 24 months in 1901. Our current service level included the population changes through the October 98 forecast, and we established an overtime, temporary employee, and differential budget for the existing boot camps. That was an oversight in prior budgets. We have four policy packages in this program unit. Package 90 has program reductions that reduces general fund by just under $1 million. It reorganizes the support service at Hillcrest and McLaren and slightly reduces the inflation rate on service and supplies. The second package, 91, is the second look measure. That eliminates 59 beds, as Rick explained. That's the estimate of the impact of the second look legislation. And the direct cost of the operation savings is just under $4 million in 30 positions.
So can I just go another question? I'm a little perplexed why we would craft a budget on pinning our hopes on that a bill passes. Isn't it customary to pass a budget on what's currently in law, or what we're currently dealing with, rather than looking for less funding, pinning that on a bill that might pass?
Madam Chair, because of the effective date of the bill, if it has an emergency clause or enabling clause, it doesn't take effect until a time certain after the legislature adjourns. Typically what we do is do the budget predicated on that not being included. And then the emergency fund can also, the Ways and Means can set aside some money in the emergency fund for the agency to come back and draw down against whatever impact there will be. I don't know, they're talking about a $120 million ending balance. That's what the leadership is talking about. So there'd be $120 million to meet the demand. If the House bill doesn't pass, then there'll be a drawdown on emergency funds. I would assume that's probably what will happen. Right, Mr. McGee? Or request to use part, a portion of them or something?
Madam Chair, Senator Hannah, if I can answer both your questions. It is not unusual for the governor's budget to be predicated on legislation either that would increase the budget or decrease the budget.
Okay.
So it's not done, particularly reductions are not done very frequently, but it is not an unusual circumstance for us to see legislation that should be included in the governor's budget assumptions.
Otherwise, you wind up committing general funds for something that may in fact not happen.
Okay.
And so that's the reason you take the budget as is, not we're working on that right now with ODOT budget. We have to take it as how much funds are being generated now versus what happens if the revenue package passes or fails.
Right. Well, they indicated that if we don't pass second look, then there's going to be a $6 million hole in this budget.
Yeah.
So then they'll come to the E-Board.
Yes. To the emergency board.
Okay. Thank you. Representative.
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the committee, if I could just expand on that a little bit. The fiscal impact for the second look bill is this $4 million general fund savings. If that does not pass, there are other policy choices that the subcommittee or the legislature could consider in terms of filling that $6 million hole. So it's not that if second look doesn't pass, you don't have any other choices. There are other choices, but if the budget is intended to fully fund the current forecast, then yes, it would take about an additional $6 million.
Okay, thank you.
And one other clarification, of course, the emergency fund, which I don't know what the leadership is considering, would be where we request the ending balance would require a special session to be able to address.
But if the economy goes down just in the least, we'll be back in the special session.
I understand. Perfect. Absolutely. Moving on, package 202 is a bed capacity forecast. When the legislature in 1995 adopted Senate Bill 1 and increased the funding for closed custody beds in the youth authority, the number of beds that were authorized for discretionary beds, the non-WAVE, the non-Measure 11, the juvenile adjudications, the legislature increased those number of beds by 100. And that was interpreted as a fixed increase in number of beds for these kids. Now that we have the Office of Economic Analysis forecast in place, which we didn't at that time, this package would, in essence, increase the discretionary beds to the number that is forecast, and in the future have that discretionary bed forecast be included in the current service level. It would fund the youth authority population increases in the same way that you fund the growth in the Department of Corrections population increases. So this is, in essence, almost a technical issue for 40 beds and about $1.5 million general fund. And the last package that was in the governor's budget was an increase in staff training and service improvements, increasing the training for new employees from 88 hours to 120 hours, and annual update training from 8 hours to 20 hours. Increased staff training was recommended by the independent panel that was appointed to review OIA operations after the Hillcrest suicide. This package is $1,000,001. It is eliminated in the governor's revised budget.
Any questions?
The items in the governor's revised budget for the facilities program unit are funding the closed custody population forecast that was released in April 99, which a few weeks ago, eliminating the policy package for staff training that I just mentioned, eliminating one administrative position in the facilities, basically shifting some of the operations costs from general fund to other funds, is the amount that will be received from the Department of Education under the Federal Student Nutrition Fund will be larger than had been projected in the budget through the population increases. We have a correction for an error in how personal service costs were estimated for the governor's budget, and we're asking for the establishment of an other fund expenditure limitation for the canteen at the institutions and the work program sales. That's always occurred. We basically put that on budget now. Okay. The reduction here is a general fund reduction of $1.3 million and other funds increase of $843,000. And because of the population forecast increases, there's a four additional positions and three additional fees. That will be my presentation.
Any questions?
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bob Jester, and I am the area coordinator for the North Valley region of the Oregon Youth Authority. And in this capacity, I am responsible for the administrative oversight of McLaren, Hillcrest, and our LEAF Secure program in Multnomah County. I am working from page 25 of the presentation document with a picture of the youth on the front. 25. Referring to the chart that we talked about on Monday, the OIA services and sanctions, the OIA facility programs fall right in the middle of a continuum of programs and services that the youth authority either provides or contracts for. And that's what we'll be talking about today. If you would refer to the pie chart on the left-hand column of page 25, you will see that the institution program budget comprises about 45% of the Oregon Youth Authority's budget, and the community programs comprise about 42%. The reason I believe this is important is that we do attempt to operate a balanced service delivery of services and sanctions, both in the community before the need for OIA institutions and following OIA institutions when youth return to their home communities. The Youth Authority operates a graduated sanctions within our facilities, which are designed to provide accountability, reformation opportunities to youth offenders while ensuring the public's protection. We operate 8 secure youth correctional facilities, 4 work-study camps, and 3 youth accountability camps. We receive youth under 3 status. We receive youth directly from juvenile court who are committed as youth offenders. We receive youth who have committed Measure 11 offenses, have been tried as adults, placed in the legal custody of the Department of Corrections, and transferred to OIA because of their age. These offenders are under the age of 18. And we receive youth who have committed non-Measure 11 offenses, have been waived to adult court, placed in the legal custody of the Department of Corrections, and are transferred to OIA because of their age. This group is also under the age of 18. So those are the 3 groups of youth that we serve, youth offenders. Approximately 1/3 of our population are transferred from Department of Corrections. Approximately 2/3 of our population are youth that come into the juvenile court. If you return to page 26, all youth offenders are assessed upon entry into an Oregon Youth Authority correctional facility. This assessment is to determine what their individual reclamation needs are, what their individual educational needs, vocational training needs, and to identify their risk classification for public protection purposes. Following this assessment period, youth are then assigned to a facility and the reclamation plan is updated. And the reclamation plan is the map, if you will take the youth offender through our facility, transition them back to their community, and provide for continued supervision and services upon their return from the community. And this reclamation plan is first crafted when a youth has initial contact with the judicial system. So at the juvenile court level, the juvenile department worker would most likely be the first person who would begin the reclamation plan.
Reclamation services, which are a cornerstone of the OIA facilities, are provided across the continuum in all of our programs. In the new regional secure facilities, these programs are contracted with private providers who actually come in to the facility and provide such services as alcohol and drug treatment, violent offender treatment, sex offender treatment, parent training, medical, dental, psychiatric, psychological, mental health services are all contracted with private providers in the community. At McLaren and Hillcrest, these services are predominantly provided by state staff. However, we do look at vacancies and determine if there is an efficiency in another way of doing business, and some of these have been converted into contracts. We spoke earlier in the introduction overview about the risk factors that youth offenders bring with them when committed to the youth authority and placed in our facilities. Remembering that 78% are involved with alcohol or other substance abuse, 45% are diagnosed with mental health illness, 31% have had past suicidal behaviors, 37% come from families where a parent has committed a crime, 22% have been sexually abused, and 60%, which is a conservative estimate, are special education qualified. Our reclamation services are designed around the risk factors that these youth come into our facilities with. We provide individual treatment, group treatment, and contractor professional treatment to youth. Our treatment programs are centered around cognitive restructuring, where there is a learning process, if you will, to correct thinking errors, for youth to assume personal responsibility and accountability for their behaviors and their offenses against others, for them to take emotional ownership for the pain and suffering that victims have had to endure because of their behaviors. So all of our programs have a cognitive overlay to them. We are involved in providing family treatment. I'm just reading from the list under the Reclamation Services. Our Minority Affairs program is a very strong program in all of our facilities. We have parenting classes that are both part of the academic portion of our institutional programs as well as the treatment portion. Again, we have the full continuum of psychological, psychiatric, mental health, as well as medical and dental services. Our transition services, which are extremely important to the youth success upon return to the community. Work experience, we believe it is important for youth to work while they're in our programs, not only to offset the state and taxpayers' costs of the operation, but also to learn good work habits and work skills. At McLaren, during the calendar year 1998, youth earned in one program alone $27,500 toward restitution payments to victims in a public-private partnership with an industry where they assemble cedar lattice for fencing. Moving down to page 27. Our youth correctional facilities, the secure facilities, of which there are eight, are our highest security with the most intensive accountability for youth offenders with a strong component of public protection. We have McLaren Youth Correctional Facility in Woodburn, which I think most people are familiar with having heard about. It has 318 beds. It deals with older male youth from Marion, Multnomah, Clackamas County, as well as McLaren handles all of the Department of Correction male intake and a large number of the Department of Corrections male offenders that are programmed in OIA are programmed at McLaren. Hillcrest Youth Correctional Facility.
Sure. Yes. Does that bed count include those temporary beds that you put into the facility, if I forget, 1995 or something like that?
Madam Chair, Senator Timms, the base of McLaren is the 318 beds. Additionally, we have the 50 temporary beds that we are using for the Central Eastern Oregon Youth Accountability Camp, which is not yet constructed
and we have 50 beds located there for the North Valley Youth Accountability Camp. And those youth are being housed in the temporary facilities that were constructed to accommodate the intake of Measure 11 offenders prior to the completion of our secure regional facilities. So those temporary structures are being reused for Youth Accountability Camp offenders.
But when they move out of those, you're not moving the structures, you're moving the people that are in them to the other system, and then they will be vacant at that time?
Madam Chair, Senator Timms, I believe that the projection for population will reuse these facilities.
Those are 50 beds.
Madam Chair, Senator Timms, that's correct.
Gee, it just seemed like a more beds than that, but I guess I'm not remembering it well. That's been 4 or 6 years ago. You were at that time.
Madam Chair, Senator Timms, the total capacity of the temporary beds at McLaren is 120.
Okay. That makes more sense.
Each of the soft-sided structures has a 30-bed capacity, and there are 4 of those structures. We have been operating them at 25, which is the optimum number.
And they have worked out tremendously well, right?
Senator Timms, they've been very effective. Not only were they quick to install, but they provide very good supervision, and the design provides for a tremendous amount of volume for the amount of floor space. And we have not had any problems with youth challenging the fabric structure.
Okay, so those could be used for what purpose down the line?
Madam Chair, Senator Timms, our intention would be to reuse those for housing of youth offenders in the future.
Senator Hannon?
Yes.
How are the ones that are sent to the penitentiary, the 15, 17, 18-year-old ones, how are those beds classified? Do you rent those from corrections in exchange for them housing the inmates?
Madam Chair, Senator Hannon, the Oregon Youth Authority's budget accommodates the DOC offenders that we are programming. So they are being housed within our budget. We do not receive additional funds from Department of Corrections to house those youth.
No, I didn't mean you receiving money. Does Department of Corrections receive money from you to house your inmates?
Madam Chair, Senator Hannon, no, because they are actually Department of Corrections. They are in the legal custody of Department of Corrections.
Even though they're 16, 17, 18-year-olds?
That's correct.
Under what kind of circumstance would a person go from the Oregon Youth Authority facility, detention center, or whatever else, to that kind of correction situation?
Madam Chair, Senator Hannah, that's an excellent question. And there are a variety of circumstances that would result in our administratively reviewing a 16 or 17-year-old for consideration of transfer back to Department of Corrections. One of those would be a youth offender's insistence upon not staying in a youth authority facility, but going to an adult corrections facility. And many times they either have family or friends that are in a DOC facility, and they want to be closer to them. The other thing which we find is that there are some offenders at 16, 17 that absolutely refuse to participate in treatment or educational programming. I mean, they are not going to do it. And there comes a point in time that it is contrary to the use of our resources to continue to try and engage them in that process. And we don't take those transfers lightly. The third category of offender that we review for transfer back to DOC are offenders that are violently acting out, either hurting other youth offenders or our staff. And there is a difference in the threshold between the Department of Corrections and their security and Oregon Youth Authority. Our staff are not armed, and we have some youth that, quite frankly, are so dangerous in their behaviors that they should be in an adult correctional facility.
Thank you.
Representative Merrick.
Madam Chair, I have 2 things. One is more specific to this topic. Another is more general. I don't know if you've invited the folks who have their children here to introduce them.
No, we have not.
Would it be a focus meeting after they could ask them to do that?
Absolutely.
It'd be fun to hear from the folks who brought the children to work today if they'd like to introduce them.
Some of them,
yeah.
Well, thank you.
Welcome.
We do have a...
Mike and Alex Casper is here visiting today. I'm bringing a father.
Wonderful.
Welcome. Now, may I proceed?
Yes.
On the fabric structures, I'll call them that, at McLaren, they have a shorter life cycle. And my question is, are we looking towards when we are going to deconstruct them or pull them offline, or are we unfortunately pressuring ourselves to hang on to them longer than we need to?
Madam Chair, Representative Mannix, original intent was to occupy those facilities until we built our permanent regional facilities. We found that they have held up much better than we thought they would. We think we can recycle them at least one more time. In other words, delay construction one more growth cycle. We hope to then use them for things like shops, classrooms, recreation areas. We built them with high ceilings and a lot of volume, as Bob mentioned, so that we can do a lot of different things in them. They are guaranteed for I think, 20 years, and you can replace the skin. So you can recycle them again. I want to point out that we do have them fenced in with a 15-foot perimeter fence, so even if they get through the soft-sided structure, there is a barrier. And also, even though we say they were inexpensive, and they were about $600,000 a piece, so that's $2.4 million for 120 beds. That's pretty cheap. But we didn't have to build food service. We didn't have to build the other infrastructure. Things around them because we built those on the McLaren campus. So if you were to do this as a standalone project, it would be much more expensive. But we're very happy with them.
Are there other OYA facilities where you might find that kind of construction in the short term helpful and useful, where you could then say that your plan would be then to, again, shift the activity to something else?
Madam Chair, Representative Mannix, I think when we get into further growth in the youth authority down the road in the next decade, I would certainly look at those for minimum security facilities located around the state to pick up some of our work camp kids, pick up perhaps high-level alcohol and drug clients who aren't a particular threat to the community where we replace them. There are building code issues, unfortunately, around these structures in some locales. It was a little bit difficult to get all of the permits we needed right away because they are not traditional construction.
Can I respond to that?
Mm-hmm.
May I suggest, I don't remember what committee it's in, but it did have a hearing. There was a bill that allowed the Department of Corrections to get exemption from the building code. I don't remember if the lighting clause was broad enough. Is it not broad enough?
We're watching it, Bill.
I have it. Well, the word that I got was the corrections and building codes people decided that the building codes people could accommodate corrections through the regulation process so that they were not going to proceed with the bill. And my thinking would be that since the bill was heard, there is one last shot next week at a work session. If the youth authority needs to have some exemption for these kinds of facilities, this might be a good time to look at that. And if I may, one more thing, Madam Chair. The other thing I would encourage us to look at as we're looking at a period of respite is to be cautious about too much respite when we might want to put some facilities online that we could short-term make available to the counties to supplement their needs or address their needs and give ourselves our own breathing room as a state so that when our needs come online, we're not catching up again. And I'm hoping that we could stay ahead of the eight ball without creating a market but responding to our needs. And is that something that I don't think we need to do anything in this budget, but I would hope that we'd be sensitive to that as we look on to the next couple of biennia.
Senator Hammer?
Yeah, Madam Chair. I just looked at your figure here, 2,400,000 for
120 beds. 20,000 hours a bed. What is the operational cost of running the same beds?
Madam Chair, Senator Hannon, the operational cost would be the same as it would be for traditional construction. Depends on how many staff and how many youth you have in there. For 30 youth, it would be, on a daily basis, it would be $130 a day. On an annual basis, for 30 beds, do the math, I don't know, about $600,000 a year, I would think.
And this temporary bed or kind of a gap situation, what's the typical length of time that it's used before you convert to a regular fund system?
Senator Hannon, that has to do with the growth curve on the bed forecast.
So in other words, you're hedging all bets against McLaren being able to take the additional workload as the workload increases.
According to the long-range forecast, the prison bed forecast, which goes out to 2008, we will not need to start any new construction until 2003, as we read the forecast right now, given that we can work into these temporary structures once again, recycle them. And we also have the second hedge, which is that we can rent space from several of the counties who have built new detention centers if we have to.
Okay. Thank you.
And again, that assumes the passage of the second look. So.
Continuing on page 27, the Hillcrest Youth Correctional Facility, which is here in Salem, has 181 bed capacity. It is a coeducational facility dealing with both male and female offenders, and it houses some of the youngest youth offenders in the state. The Multnomah Leased Facility in Portland, which is housed at Multnomah County JDH, is a 32-bed very secure, highly structured program that is operated on a coeducational basis and is used for short-term intervention program for youth who are not otherwise responding appropriately to their programming in our regional facilities and McLaren and Hillcrest. So it is really a behavior modification program that we move youth into. Average length of stay is 30 days, although some youth stay as long as 60. Then they return to the facility from which they came. The regional facilities, which we brought for members that have joined us since we started, we did bring the architect's model of the regional facilities for your look-see. We still hope to get folks out on the tour, but if that doesn't happen, this is what one looks like. They are a combination of dormitory sleeping as well as individual rooms. They are state-of-the-art, very secure, self-contained facilities. They are designed to provide the full spectrum of treatment reformation services while protecting the public and are designed to be co-gender. Shifting to the top of page 28, the North Coast facility in Warrenton has 72 state beds and 20 detention beds. The Oak Creek Youth Correctional Facility in Albany has 72 state beds and 20 county detention beds. The Rogue Valley Youth Correctional Facility in Grants Pass has 96 state beds. Ochoco Youth Correctional Facility in Prineville has 48 state beds. And the Eastern Oregon Youth Correctional Facility in Burns has 40 state beds and 10 county detention beds. The 10 county detention beds in the Burns facility, which their operation has not been funded by the counties to be used as detention, we currently are housing 10 of the Central Eastern Oregon Youth Accountability Camp youth in those beds. And so that facility is operating currently at its capacity.
Madam Chair. Now, the last time I was there, they had a Ways and Means sub
committee there at the time and returned that, they weren't in use. They are in use now, you're saying, the detention beds, which we had that there for a year without. And I know it's not your fault. It's the fault of the parents who want to pay the cost of keeping those there. Didn't you say that they were in full use?
Madam Chair, Senator Pence, I'd like to correct my statement with your guidance and assistance here. We are currently housing 50 youth in the Eastern Oregon Youth Correctional Facility by increasing the two state units to 25 beds, and the 10 detention beds are vacant. So we are not actually using those 10 beds, although we have added 10 state youth to that facility so that it is operating at the level that it would had detention be funded.
Now, do we have any use for those 10 detention beds, which are separate from the other part of the facility, which are dormitory types? As these are segregated beds throughout the system. What are our plans to use those, which currently, you know, the staff and all your costs of operation would not go up as much as they would if you had a separate unit on that? Because you're paying for a lot of it right now, food, heating, the whole thing.
Madam Chair, Senator Tim, our first hope is that the counties in the region will raise money to be able to operate it as county detention, which is what it was intended for and designed for. I think we'll hear on Tuesday during public testimony from some people from COJAC in Eastern Oregon about their great desire to do that. I don't know that those counties, those four counties out there, can raise that kind of money. If they can't, there are certainly other uses for that. We could grow into that space as state beds as our bed forecast goes up. It's a wonderful space. It's single cell, 10 beds. It's very secure. It could be a variety of different programs. It could be a program for some drug treatment. It could be a secure program for sex offenders. It could be a program. Could be a high-intensive treatment program operated by the private sector, operating similar to the CHUT program. There's lots of options. We want to work with the local juvenile directors in Oregon to come up with the best solution. There's also an interest from some of the Indian tribes in Eastern Oregon that have a dire need for bed space for tribal youth that can't go through county courts. So I don't think it'll sit idle very much longer.
Great. I think the Indians probably would have the money, too, to pay for it.
Actually, Senator Tim, they don't. But,
but casinos aren't working.
Madam Chair, moving down to our work-study camp on page 29, Oregon opened its first work-study camp in 1957, and we have a long history, successful history with these programs. They actually provide a bridge from our secure custody facilities to transition youth back to the community. It provides an opportunity for youth offenders to continue with a reformation, to continue in their education, vocational training, and most importantly, it provides them the opportunity to gain vocational skills through either community service or contract work for the Parks Department or the Forest Service. And we do have numbers of public-private partnerships where the youth that are in our work-study camps are actually working for private parties in the community. In 1998, the youth that were in the work-study camps worked 40,000 hours in these situations and earned $167,000, which was available to pay restitution to victims of their crimes. We have four of these programs. Corvallis House, which has recently been converted to a young women's transition program located in Corvallis and is designed to provide unique transitional services to serve this population of young women. We hope to have the opportunity to tour you folks through that program. Camp Florence has 25 beds. It's located in Florence, Oregon. Camp Hilgard has 25 beds, and Camp Tillamook has 25 beds. On page 30, we'd like to show a quick video to you to introduce our youth accountability camp programs. And we have 150 beds in
the OYA Youth Accountability Camps, also known as boot camps. It's a quick 2-minute piece.
Robbery, but many of the worst crime stories that we have to report to you are about children who commit murder. In Pillsbury County, we found one solution for troubled teens. Sandy James has our report. These young men are serving time at the Youth Accountability Camp in Tillamook, Oregon's only boot camp for young men 15 to 18 who haven't committed real serious crimes yet. That's the key word, yet. Because the whole idea here is to turn their lives around before they become the pet tingle from Patrick Carnage. 17-year-old Brian Rogers says it's worked for him. Can you get some
questions?
Are you just telling me this because you think it's what I want to hear?
Okay.
Brian says the book has assigned responsibility and accountability and given him discipline and structure for the first time in his life.
The program says no, I'm not going to
Jamie says the 4 months you're incarcerated at the boot camp is the easy part. The 8 months after, when you have to daily contact with your parole officer, is the hard part. And if you screw up, you're in second chance. The children of kids that graduated from the boot camp will attend their assistance. Of those, only 23% have reoffended, compared to 35 to 40 who reoffend after leaving facilities like McLaren. Director Terry Yonkin credits the combination of military lifestyle, programs in care, and small enough numbers to really reach each kid.
We have a small enough environment that we're able to hold that mirror up and cautiously attack those persons. Why are you doing this?
In Tillamook, with photographer Art Wright, I'm Sandy James, 2016. Another boot camp just like that one is ready to open later this year in LaGrange.
Turning your books to page 30, if you would. The Youth Accountability Camp programs, again, we have 150 beds. These were first authorized by the 1995 legislative session to provide an alternative to longer incarceration in our secure facilities for nonviolent property offenders. And they are similar to the work-study camps with a major additional component, which is a military leadership model and physical training as key components. The first Youth Accountability Camp, as mentioned in the video, opened in Tillamook in March of 1997. We actually constructed the facility on property adjacent to the work-study camp to garner some efficiencies in food service, management, clerical support, motor pool transportation, things of that nature. The Eastern Oregon Youth Accountability Camp, which is being built in Hilgard, is also being built on property adjacent to our work-study camp to garner the same efficiencies around support services to reduce the cost of these programs. And the North Valley Youth Accountability Camp, which I previously mentioned, is housed in the temporary structure at McLaren Youth Correctional Facility.
In comparison to what we had, the military's youth boot camp program here,
OYC,
Oregon Youth Challenge. The cost difference between like that. But OYC is not, it's not adjudicated youth or anything either, or is it? Do you know? Or?
Madam Chair, Representative Patridge, on page 16 of the overview, there is a cost comparison with the Oregon Youth Authority program, and youth accountability camps and the work study camps are priced, the second one down on that list, is $94.81 a day, and I do not know the cost per day of the other programs.
Representative Patrick, I can try and get that information for you from military department. I don't have that information.
But I think they're non-adjudicated.
Yes, it is a different kind of.
Yeah.
Representative Wesley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The well, it's true to say those youth are not adjudicated. I don't know what percentage. It's a fairly high, you know, 50% is a conditional discharge type of thing. So I mean, they are at the system's doorstep. I mean, very similar types of offenders, I think. And I think the cost, but that's only, and I think, is pretty comparable. I don't think there's any huge cost advantage one way or another. But let's check on that. That's a good answer. Thank you, Madam Chair.
One of the very important components of the Oregon Youth Authority's youth accountability camps is our intensive transition aftercare model. And this is a model where we have specialized parole caseloads to serve smaller numbers of youth offenders and actually become involved with these youth at an intense level while they're still in the program. And there is daily contact when they first return to their home communities. And there is an 8-month targeted period of supervision following the 4-month youth accountability camp program. So essentially what we are asking youth to do is to buy into a 4-month intensive treatment program of cognitive restructuring, military drill, physical training, and going out in the community and follow through with significant contact by a parole officer, again, as often as once per day when they're first released for 8 months, making it a 1-year total program. And we have, up to this point, had a 23% recidivism rate of these youth versus a 35% recidivism rate overall. So we feel that the model is a very successful one, although it is early.
Representative
Thank you, Madam Chair. What was that recidivism rate again?
Madam Chair, Representative Westland, the recidivism rate for the youth accountability camps is 23%.
Follow-up, Madam Chair. Over what period of time? And how long have you been tracking these kids?
Representative Westland, this program is in operation 2 years now, and that 23% represents all the kids that have been released during that 2-year period. It's different than our 1-year recidivism chart we had up there Monday, where our 1-year return rate is about 28% for our whole system, but in tracking these kids for that second year, it's still only gone up to 23%. So of all the kids that have been through there in 2 years, 23% of them have committed new law violations.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Patrick?
What's your fallout rate?
Excellent question, Madam Chair, Representative Patrick. We'll have to get you the exact figure because I don't think we have it here today, unless somebody behind me has it quickly. But my guess is that it's about 15%, maybe less. We do some pre-screening before we send kids in to this program, and we also have a staging area at McLaren so that they get a couple of weeks of orientation before they go to the boot camp in Tillamook. So they are oriented to the drill and to the discipline and to the expectation before they go. So there's some drop out there with some kids that we may have misclassified or misjudged whether they can handle it. And that has really helped with the washout rate.
Madam Chair, Representative Patridge, additionally, these are youth that the local juvenile department and court has been collaborating with OYA around the placement in a youth accountability camp. There is a local agreement that this youth is well suited for that kind of a program, and oftentimes that's been discussed prior to the commitment. And the staging area has been extremely effective in providing youth the opportunity to see what the youth accountability camp is going to be like, and there's probably a greater washout rate from the McLaren staging area where youth say this isn't for me. But we really hope that the youth that finally make it to the camp are the ones that are going to complete the program. That's our goal.
Okay.
On page 31, you will find a map of where the Oregon Youth Authority has programs located. And the significance of this is prior to the construction of the 5 new secure regional facilities and the Tillamook Youth Accountability Camp and the new Youth Accountability Camp in Hilgard, Oregon, we were essentially a centralized service delivery system in OYA with four work-study camps located around the state. And as you will see, we have really moved the services and sanctions of these facilities out to the communities in the various parts of the state. On page 32, we have the program reduction package number 90. And as Mr. McGee and I believe Mr. Hill talked briefly about in the overview, this is a $869,000 general fund cut, and it is predicated on our ability to gain additional efficiencies in the operation of McLaren Hillcrest by combining more of the support services functions between these two institutions. And the areas that we are continuing to look at are records, personnel, food services, which we feel is a big potential area to garner additional savings, as well as medical services, transportation, et cetera. Not to say that these are not cuts. They are cuts. We plan to continue to challenge our managers to achieve a yet higher level of efficiency in the operation of these two. And it has really become possible with the regional model because they are administratively supervised together now, and so we believe we can do some combining. This also includes a 2% reduction in the services and supplies budget for the other facilities across the state. There is an additional $89,900 general fund reduction from a recalculation of the inflation factor, which finishes the program reduction package number 90. On page 33, we have the second look, Measure 11, package number 91. And this is a 5% reduction in the October 98 forecast for 59 beds, and it is predicated on the passage of House Bill 2206, which establishes offenders sentenced to mandatory minimum terms of imprisonment for certain crimes committed when they were 15, 16, or 17 years of age, could be eligible for early release or reduction of sentence under certain circumstances. And the general fund savings in package number 91 is just under $4 million.
Package 206 on the next page is the program option package that talks about the 40 discretionary beds. 202. Okay. And Mr. McGee explained that earlier. This is a situation where in 1995 you were given 100 beds to accommodate additional property offenders or juvenile commitment beds into our system after we did away with the quote cap that we lived with for 10 years. The situation was during the time we lived with the cap that our commitment rate was increasing with person-to-person crime use going up. Taking all the beds we had, we only had 513 beds for 10 years now. As a result of property center commitment, it started dropping dramatically. We had no room for them. So we went from 7 commitments for 10,000 of property center down to 2.2 for 10,000. And had this trend continued, where no property defenders had beds in our institutions, and all the beds would have been taken by a certain criminal. The problem with that is in order to get into the system, had to commit a person-to-person crime. We were missing the chance to intervene early with property defenders. When we projected the number of beds needed in 1995, we split the difference, made an assumption that it really needed to go up to where it was, probably not as high as it had been. We set it at 5 to 10,000. That's what we based our forecast on in 1995. So we were given 100 beds by the 95 legislation. The question was that a one-time deal, or should that be worked into the forecast
that's now done by the Office of Economic Analysis. So in granting this program option package, which as Mr. McGee said is really at the technical change, you're also making policy that from now on we will be able to reflect the growth of property dependent debt needs as well as person to person. That math is based on that in 1994.
Representative Schrader?
Any problem with it? Assuring the relative safety of the different types of offenders, or are they both pretty much the same behavioral model, i.e. the property client people versus the person-to-person people?
Madam Chair, Representative Schrader, are you referring to the kind of facility that, that these
right, offenders... Do you keep them together? Do you segregate them?
A couple things. The youth accountability camps have been designed to hold first-time property offenders, nonviolent offenders, and as we earlier talked about, this has been a very effective model for the youth authority to do. At McLaren, Hillcrest, as well as the regional facilities, we do have property offenders that are mixed with those youth who have committed person-to-person offenders, and oftentimes the reformation needs are very similar. They are far behind in education, they have alcohol and drug treatment issues, they have family issues, and that is what the program is centered on, as well as the public safety aspect of keeping these youth contained and the public safe during the period of time that they are taking care of their reformation needs. Thank you.
Representative
Patridge. I'm not very familiar with the sentencing that goes on with juveniles, much more so than any adult system. I'm just wondering from a forecasting standpoint, in the adult system, we have the sentencing guidelines, obviously, and all on all those, and that's how they determine a lot of the Fed forecasting. Typically, how's it done from a juvenile basis? I think you can maybe start at a very basic level and explain how you go about doing that. As we look at property offender crimes and some of those things, how are those taken into account in light of the adult criminal laws that we have, in light of the three strikes we have? How it's kind of thing, if we're setting policy by doing this, I'm interested to know or at least if that's your feel that we're setting policy by doing this. I'm interested to know where we're going trend-wise.
Madam Chair, Representative Patridge, the methodology that Suzanne Porter uses to do our forecasting summarized to some degree on page 8 in the agency summary. And I think also in the appendix, tab number 8 in the appendix has her executive summary on how she does the methodology. But in a nutshell, for juvenile sentences, which are all indeterminate,
right.
She went on the past history of how long we keep kids, what is our average length of stay. She divided them up into certain categories, crime categories, property offenders, first offenders. But also age is a factor in the juvenile system, as it is not in the adult system. If a kid comes in at age 12 for a person-to-person crime, even though maybe it's not a determinant sentence for juvenile court, it's going to stay longer than kids who come in at age 17 because there's a lot more to do with a 12-year-old than there is a 17-year-old, and the behavior is not yet mature enough to stabilize. So there's no easy way to predict this. There's no constants. There's no factors mathematically to grab onto. So she's just going back and got the history over a period of years. What are our trends? How long do we keep these kids? And traditionally, that's been between 4 and 8 months for property offenders. But there are variations based on age. But it, so it isn't very long compared to what would happen in the sentencing guideline situation. So it is not exact science.
What appendix is that?
And page 4 is the methodology. Madam Chair, Representative Patridge, additionally, a difference between the adult correction system and the Oregon Youth Authority
is that many of these property offenders who leave our more secure facilities or youth accountability camps are not returning to their homes or living independently, but are going to another level of care, either from a contract youth care center, a supervised group home, or a foster home. And the kind of supervision and engagement with our parole and probation staff is different than that with adult offenders. And the criteria in which they are released is very different as well, in terms of attending school, working, curfew hours, contacts with other offenders. I mean, there's very specific behavioral and public safety contracts that we put these youth on.
As a follow-up, Madam Chair, so you count, you said between 4 and 8 months is fairly typical. I'm trying to figure out what kind of property offenses they're getting 4 to 8 months on. Are these, you know, felony kinds of property offenses, because that's way outside what a sentencing guideline grid would be in adult corrections. And so, I mean, the disparity is a huge disparity. I mean, you're going to get, you know, 10 to 20 days in an adult system.
Representative Thatcher, just doesn't have very much to do at all with the crime. It has everything to do with the behavior of youth, how well they're adjusting in the institution, what it's going to take to get them to where they can go out into a less secure setting or back home again, and often it depends on their other issues, their mental health issues, their behavior issues, their educational issues, their resource issues. Is there a resource that will take the youth out? We're talking about car theft, we're talking about burglary, we're talking about drug offenses, we're talking about combinations of those things, we're talking about kids who have committed 20, 30, 40 burglaries who finally get caught. It's all across the board. And that's why we've never had determinate sentencing. And the state of Washington has determinate sentencing for juveniles. And they're forced continually to let kids out way before they're ready, or to hold kids much too long. And it's not a good system for recidivism. It's not a good system for getting results.
Representative Provancy?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think the other thing, Rick, is my understanding of the youth situation is the philosophy is reformation, even though we have moved into a more detention-centered, because of the flexibility, it gives you the ability to work on an individual case-by-case analysis.
That is very correct.
Senator
Smith? And Madam Chair, I've been out facility in Burns 3 or 4 times. The intensity price where I was, it cost was $44,000 a year, I believe, for the juvenile and the programs that they put them through, and the intensity of the, like, I can see where that would be the way to go, because you can tell if that child is, or you're going to have an idea whether he's rehabilitated. In many cases, they're so bad on drugs and those kind of things that it's, you can just tell the ones that are learning and the ones that aren't. It's a very intense system.
Representative Schrader?
Kind of following up on Senator Kim's, the package here alone, in package 202, the 40 beds went about $30,000 per individual then per bed. And there's 20 positions included. I'm not sure what that 20 positions are, and I'm going to put just off in, you know, for the facility and maintaining the facility, and I assume there's additional cost on top of that for all the treatment programs and stuff. But I kind of wanted to know how much does it cost per individual with some
Madam Chair, Representative Schrader, that's an inclusive cost. That includes the reformation services, and depending on where the bed was placed, would either be contracted in the private sector for folks to come in to provide that service, or it would be provided by a combination of state staff and contract staff.
Madam Chair, Representative Schrader, the costs that are reflected here, the calculation sometimes depends on whether they need a whole new ward or a whole new unit for that and additional staff as opposed to whether they can put them into a current one. But in terms of an average per day cost, there was information, I think, on the first day of testimony that was handed out that showed it's about $132 a day at the governor's budget level. And that includes everything except for the Department of Education's educational program costs, which are funded out of the state school fund. But it includes the treatment and the facility staffing, as well as the overhead, if you will.
The budget that we're looking at, though, is quite a bit less than the overall OA budget. And I assume there's a lot of programs stuff. Is that correct? This is only a portion of the budget, facilities and debt service. And
yes, that is true. That the facility doesn't include the debt service costs, but it does include the other costs that are associated with staffing those debts.
Maybe I'm just probably the only one confused here, as usual. So I thought the budget for OA was in a $200,000 range overall, not...
It would be about $130 a day times 365, so that's about $40,000,
$44,000
a year. You may be referring to a biennial cost.
Right.
For some reason, I was thinking another figure, a much higher figure in my mind, but I think I must have been including the construction figure, which is depends on your permanent bed versus your so-called 20,000 for the shorter term beds and perhaps 40,000 or more for the higher, 60? Higher, 65.
No. Permanent construction, that's the max, is over $100,000 a bed. It's easily 100,000, 110,000, 120,000, depending on the size of the facility. The cost actually that we use for the calculation of this package is $94 a day, and that is not the 130
that's the youth accountability type.
Well, actually, it's a combination of it's an average of our construction system. So to add and subtract beds, when we do these budget packages, we do it at $94 a day, not the full 130. The full 130 does include, like, the entire administration of an institution. So this would just be adding cottages or that type of thing. So it's less than 130 for this package.
Mr. McGee.
Madam Chair, Reverend Schrader, just for clarification, the budget you're seeing today is just the facilities and debt service budget, and that's $120 million. The whole budget for the agency is 207 general fund. Tomorrow we'll get into the community programs, and then following that, the administration might do the rest of it. Well, that kind of gets to my basic question. We're kind of factoring those out as if they're not part of each individual, and actually you should be accounting for them as part of the total cost per individual.
Mr. Chair, Representative Schrader, the program that we're talking about today is just the kids who are in the physical institution. What you hear about tomorrow are the kids who are being managed in foster care and residential treatment under parole and probation. They're the kids that are out of institution. So the per day cost is just what it costs to keep the kid in an OIA facility.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Mary?
Thank you. Although this might not be the right committee to ask this question, it might be helpful in further discussion. Have you ever thought about what I'll call a quasi-second look process, where you redefine secure custody and you say that someone who is reviewed is determined to be in a improved secure custody mode or altered secure custody mode, which would include, say, an electronic bracelet and a prescription as to where the person may be, including, for instance, a home, school, or home work, where there's some monitoring of that circumstance for extended time while we watch and see how those folks do.
Madam Chair, Representative Mannix, we'd be more than interested in looking at that kind of a model. Currently, the Measure 11 youth are under the legal custody of the Department of Corrections, and they have responsibility for the aftercare treatment of them. And we would not be opposed to accepting that back for these youth. We would require some funds to do that kind of intense community supervision that would be far less than the cost of incarceration.
But the trick would be that technically they'd be in custody. So if there's a problem, your modification of custody doesn't require an adjudication or hearing process. You simply administratively modify the custody saying there's a problem. On the other hand, you would have used what would have been a second look process to evaluate the candidates for this pretty carefully And to be frank about it, you would want to clean the best candidates for this process, to test it under the best of all possible circumstances, including the need, say, to have already identified a job as well as a place to stay or particular schooling and a place to stay, and then some limited parameters about where the person is. Some limited movement, but because there's, say, an electronic bracelet involved, you could say it's appropriate security for that individual.
I think some of the concern around the second look is that they're either, seems like there's only two choices, they're locked up and they're safe, or they're free in the community without supervision. Certainly the middle ground is terrible.
If I may, Madam Chair, it would just occur to me that perhaps in the next few days you might talk to corrections about how that model might be implemented as a modification of the security standards rather than a modification of the customer.
Thank you. Mr. Lawson, I'm trying to move along with this. But it's always astounding to me, and I use it all the time. Really, it's basically $54,000 a year that we spend when we put the $10,000 basically in education costs in the other, which is $108,000 for 2 years for a juvenile that's incarcerated, I guess would be the proper terminology. Have we been able to tell since we got away from the cap, so everyone we had in there committed murder darn near, the others didn't have to go, to where we can show that this process, because as extensive as it is, it seems to me that it was such a different turn from what we had before. We just weren't sending anybody away. And it's awful easy to look good, because we didn't have any place to put them. Now we're spending $104,000 in the 2 year span, and I think Kevin, or Representative Maddox, has a good idea. You know, there has to be a step in between, it seems like, and we do have parole and those type things. But do we have any record I guess you do have recidivism for the time that you've had them there, but been so short, how do we tell?
Well, Madam Chair, we are looking at the Department of Corrections to see how many of our graduates, how many of our youth show up in their system, and that's what we call a crossover study, and we had been tracking that for 8 years, and we were finding that only 1 in 5 would show up over there, less than that for the more serious offenses. The problem with that study, and the reason we didn't bring it forth this session, is because of the change with Measure 11, so many of those youth are already in the Department of Corrections legal custody because of the waiver and because of Measure 11. The study just lost its validity. But we still check every once in a while and see how many of our kids show up in prison in the Department of Corrections. We have no way of checking around the country to other states, and it's very easy to lose track of these kids. Once they're out, they can relocate, and their records are, in many cases, sealed, and we never find them again. And if they're doing well, they don't want to be found. So, they just want to live their lives. It's very hard to do long-range follow-up studies. We do have a study from the University of Oregon called the TRACS study. It's done by Professor Bullock. And he's about done with that. It's a 4-year longitudinal study for a sample of our kids from a fire in the Hillcrest. We don't have that for this week or next week, but that's something that we're looking forward to. Where are those kids today and what have they done with their lives and so on and so forth. But those are very expensive studies to do. He did that with a $500,000 grant from the Department of Education and was able to track them because of their educational records, which are not expungible. Very difficult process, long-range studies.
That's so key. When you're spending that kind of money, you should know what kind of results.
And with the development of the JGIS system, the next iteration of that will connect us in with the LED system and connect us in with the adult correction system, hopefully. So we'll be able to do that for you at some point.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
We're talking about studies and recidivism rates and all those things. I'm just wondering, I'd be interested to see if there's any kind of comparison between a determinate sentencing kind of system like Washington versus an indeterminate sentencing system like ours, because if we look at $1.5 million to build new beds in I look at your trending forecast over the course of time, it looks like that will continue to build. I think that's a policy question that we need to ask. So if you have any of that information, certainly be helpful. If you don't have any of that information, then
we can try to get something from the state of Washington probably by next week.
A simple question. What is the recidivism rate for adult property offenders?
Is your question from our system or from the adult system?
The adult system. You told us it's 35 to 40% and 23 at the other camp. I'm just curious how to compare.
Mr. Administrator, we'd have to find out or get some department corrections.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, on page 35, you will see Program Option Package 206. This Program Option Package is eliminated in the Governor's revised budget. It would have extended our current new employee orientation training from 88 hours to 120 hours. And 120 hours represents what is a minimum national standard. Also was designed this package to address some of the recommendations in the Secretary of State's performance audit, as well as the Lindsay Hayes review of the Hillcrest suicide. Additionally, in this package, there was funding to provide for travel cost and post coverage because the folks we're training are ones that actually supervise youth offenders on a shift. And so when they go to training, you have to bring somebody in to cover for them, like a substitute teacher. And as I mentioned, this package is not in the governor's revised budget. On page 36, you will see a comparison between the 9901 current service level budget and the 9901 governor's recommended budget. And on page 38, you will see the comparison between the 9901 governor's recommended budget and the 9901 governor's revised budget. And the reductions which comprise the difference are bulleted at the bottom, and I believe Mr. McGee touched on those. And I would be happy to answer any questions that folks may have about.
This is probably the early discussion. I'm just curious how the FTE goes up and the amount goes down to
Madam Chair, Representative, that's because of the revised budget reflects the April bed forecast as opposed to the October bed forecast, and there's like a 15 bed increase at this time. So the FTE goes up a little bit. Yeah. The revision is from the October bed forecast to the April bed forecast.
I guess I still don't understand. I mean, I assume the dollars, FTE equals dollars, and therefore dollars go down. I would assume that all my ignorance is the FTE would go down. I can meet with them later as far as that goes.
Chair, Representative Shader, I think what you see in the governor's revised budget, where the reductions are not FTE related. So the new employee orientation package didn't add, but it added funding, so when you take that out, and the FTE remained the same, but the dollars come down.
I'm sure.
Senator,
when you talk about the discipline, or when you have a problem with them, we send them to DOC. Are we having an increase in that? What would be a savings? It would be a savings if we're sending them to DOC, taking care of them, and if that sense is going down, we are sending more kids to the Department of Correction under ballot measure 11.
Madam Chair, Senator Sims, it's holding fairly constant at about 35%. We end up keeping about 65% of the adult offenders in our system and transferring back about 35% of them. That's really not changed in the last couple
of years. So it hasn't changed in the last
couple of years.
But it wouldn't be safe. Okay. Tried.
Representative Pence.
Does DOCKOYA, if you have their for Measure 11 offenders?
Madam Chair, Senator Pat, we have individually budgeted departments based on a forecast that taking into consideration current practice of administratively moving these kids back and forth. So we don't pay them anything and they don't pay us anything. It is just a budgeted base. The forecast separates the based on practice and the money policy you've been in which system you're in.
But the physical custody belongs with DOC.
Physical custody belongs with OYA until we move them over there.
Well, no, but if they're sentenced under Measure 11, the physical custody belongs with DOC, and it's shifted back to OYA some of the time. Is that not correct? I'm getting mixed.
They have legal custody. We have physical custody.
Okay, they have. Okay.
All right.
Got it.
All right. Have one last question for Representative
Schrader. I appreciate LFO's explanation, but it just package 206 is $1 million, and the goal originally was to increase the training by about 30%. And it's just kind of hard to believe that existing trainees could do all that within that budget. I mean, usually when you see that sort of recommendation, there's usually some FTE associated with that.
Okay. Madam Chair, Representative Schrader, the FTE and the training academy are a steady number of people that would provide the training. The additional cost is for the additional hours that people who were participating in training would be away from their duty stations and their travel expenses.
Any other questions?
Not a question regarding the OIA, so I guess if there's any other questions regarding the OIA, Seva announcement I want to make.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Returning.
Based on just most, you know, recent past experience, obviously, this is through the... with regard to the budget we passed out yesterday, Oregon State Police Budget, I just again want to compliment each and every member of this committee. I've heard nothing but, you know, stimulating compliments and kudos for each committee member here. So a very heartfelt and sincere thank you from the chair. We've done good, guys. We've done good.
Yeah. Had the day off.
You had the day off on Tuesday. You might want to relate your incidents at in your judiciary committee.
The lieutenant.
Oh, thank you. We had a presentation by the state police in regard to a state police related bill. I won't bore you with those details, but it was nice that at the end the captain from the patrol division went out of his way to express his appreciation to this committee for how the state police were received in this committee and how the committee handled their appropriation measure. It's very nice.
Mm-hmm. Must have a good chair, huh?
She did great.
Thank you, Dan.
And on that note,
thank you.
Yeah, I was going to be on that one.